The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 040252, Alton J. Meyer, Meyer Acquisition Corp. and Ford Motor Company versus WMCOGP and Bullock Motor Company from Angelina County in the 9th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 040490, In re Palm Harbor Homes, Inc. and Palm Harbor Homes, ILT, DBA, Palm Harbor Village. And 040865, In re Merrill Lynch Trust Company, FSB, Merrill Lynch Life Insurance Company, and Henry Medina. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in these matters. The court will take a brief recess between each argument, and we expect to conclude all arguments before noon. These proceedings are being recorded digitally. A link to the argument should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day. The governor has nominated Chief Justice Phil Johnson of Amarillo to fill the current vacancy on the court. We are awaiting Senate action on the nomination. The court is ready to hear argument in 040252, Alton J. Meyer and Ford Motor Company versus WMCOGP and Bullock Motor Company.
May it please the court, Mr. Glenn Hsu will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners will reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The issue in this case is whether the lower court properly applied the equitable estoppel doctrine, or more specifically, whether the lower court erred in finding that WMCO, a signatory to an agreement containing an arbitration clause, was not equitably stopped from avoiding the arbitration clause when that duty in that contract was asserted against the non-signatories, Ford Motor Company and the Meyer defendants. The Court of Appeals first erred in finding that the term between the parties, which was contained in the arbitration clause, precludes the application of the equitable estoppel doctrine.
Let me ask first. Texas law governs this, not federal law, right?
That's correct.
And equitable estoppel is not a cause of action in Texas. We said just recently it's a defense mostly to limitations. Do you have any case that's ever said what the elements of equitable estoppel are and whether you can bind somebody to a contract by equitable estoppel?
There are a number of lower court cases that have applied the Fifth Circuit opinion in Grigson to the situation where...
Again, interesting if we were in federal law applied, but it doesn't. Why? I'm unaware of any case where we've ever said equitable estoppel binds somebody to a contract. Are you aware of any Texas case?
Yes.
Other than a handful of the courts of appeals in the arbitration context.
This court in the first merit case did say that a party who sues on a contract is bound by the contract.
We didn't mention equitable estoppel.
But it's this.
Yes, we didn't mention equitable
estoppel. That's correct.
Are you ever aware of us ever saying equitable estoppel binds somebody to a contract?
No. Not this court specifically along the Grigson lines.
Is ratification any different from equitable estoppel?
Equitable estoppel usually applies when a party is precluded from taking an act that they would normally be allowed to. Ratification would be, as I understand it, a situation where a party has ratified the act.
They've kept the benefit. They've received the benefits without complaint, and then having received the benefits, they change their mind and say, well, we don't want to live up to the obligations in the contract.
Correct.
And that's what you're complaining. Is that done here or not?
That is what we were complaining about.
And how did WMCO receive the benefits of their contract, which, as I understand it, never happened?
They are imposing the duties in that contract in the lawsuit against the non-signatories, Ford and the Meyer defendants. At the same time, they're trying to avoid the obligation in that contract to arbitrate those claims.
What duties are they trying to impose?
The essence of the contract was the obligation of the seller Bullock Motor Companies to transfer that dealership.
Right. Give us the car dealership. They're not asking for the car dealership.
We're asking for the benefit of the bargain if they had received the car dealership. So if, for what the Ford Motor Company and the Meyer defendants out of it, if the lawsuit had been Bullock Motor Companies, you failed to transfer the dealership on a breach of contract claim, it would be the same, short of specific performance, it would be the same thing they'd be seeking against Bullock Motor Company. The Court of Appeals held that the phrase between the parties in the arbitration provision precluded the application of the equitable estoppel doctrine. All of the cases that have recognized equitable estoppel, both the Texas lower courts, virtually all the federal circuits, and some sister states, have recognized that the equitable estoppel doctrine applies in situations where a non-signatory to the contract may compel arbitration simply because they are not a party to the contract. If they were a party to the contract, they wouldn't need to rely upon the equitable estoppel doctrine. The Grigson case from the Fifth Circuit sets out two situations in which the equitable estoppel doctrine would apply. The first is when a party must rely upon the terms of the agreement in asserting its claims against the non-signatories. And second of all, when the claims against a non-signatory and a signatory are substantially intertwined to the point that the conduct complained about would apply to both the signatory and non-signatory.
What does inextricably intertwined mean? I mean, it's got to be more than the agreement's just going to be introduced into evidence or it's relevant in some way.
Absolutely. It can't just simply be there's an agreement out there with an arbitration clause.
I'm having a hard time understanding how, on a tortious interference claim, this contract is going to be inextricably intertwined.
On the tortious interference contract claim, it's not so much the second prong of Grigson, interdependent and concerted misconduct. It's the fact that the tortious interference claim relies upon the purchase and sale agreement, which contains the arbitration clause. One of the elements of a tortious interference claim.
Well, what do you mean? It doesn't really. It introduces it as an exhibit, and it says, here's the contract we claim was interfered with.
Well, element number one would be there is a contract. Two, it was interfered with. So one of the elements of a tortious interference claim itself is the proof and the existence of the contract. The other way to look at it is if you take the fact pattern that we have, take out the purchase and sale agreement, there are no causes of action. There would be no complaint here from WMCO against Ford, Meyer, or even the Bullock Motor Companies if you take that fact, the existence of that contract, out of the fact pattern.
In Formosa Plastics, though, we held you could bring a fraudulent inducement claim. Wasn't really without having to sue on the contract. It was not a, you didn't have to sue on the contract, not an arbitration case, of course, but you're just saying I was fraudulently induced to it, had these extra costs, you don't have to, obviously, fraudulent inducement contract would be irrelevant if you hadn't actually signed the contract. But there, in that context, we said you could sue off the contract in fraud. Wouldn't that, should we have a different rule for contracts in general than arbitration clauses in particular?
I'm sorry, Justice Brewster, I'm not sure I understand.
In other words, there would be some contexts where you just said, well, if there had been no contract, there would have been no claim. That's certainly true of fraudulent inducement. But in Formosa Plastics, we said that doesn't mean you have to sue on the contract. You still have an independent tort claim. Could that be possible, or why wouldn't that be possible with arbitration clauses as well?
But I presume in the Formosa Plastic situation there would still be reliance upon, to assert that there is an extra contractual duty of fraud and inducement, you'd still have to prove that there was this contract there, and the duties that are being complained about flow from that contract.
Well,
even if the contract, you're suing upon what duties might have been in that contract.
What duties flow from the contract here that has the arbitration clause? And I mean, it seems to me like you introduce it as Exhibit 1. This is the agreement I have, and I interfered with it. But the dispute's not between the parties to that agreement.
And it wasn't between the agreement in the Grigson case by the Fifth Circuit either. In our contract, purchase sale agreement, section paragraph 1.1, has the obligation that the seller will transfer the dealership. That is the core issue among all the causes of action, among all the factual allegations in this complaint. That dealership was not transferred. Now, the only difference between a standard breach of contract claim against Bullitt Motor Companies and what we have here is that they've been converted into tort claims against non-city courts.
Why isn't that just ancillary to the cause of action? How is that so intertwined it has to be compelled to go to arbitration?
I'm sorry, how is it different?
How is it not ancillary to the cause of action?
Well, the cause of action, each of the causes of action, you know, depend upon that contract. If you read the petition, the purchase and sale agreement is referenced at least 10 times. Every one of the causes of action referenced for tortious interference, it says you tortiously interfered with the purchase and sale agreement. The illegal conspiracy claims that Ford and the Meyer defendants conspired to prevent that contract from being consummated. The fourth cause of action is that both Ford and the Meyer defendants caused the Bullitt Motor Company to breach the contract. I mean, each one of these causes of action are going to be relying upon not only the existence, but the very fact that the dealership was not transferred as promised by
But it's ancillary to the right of first refusal contract. I mean, if Ford did not want to arbitrate and WIMCO was trying to force it into arbitration, Ford's argument is going to be our defense is justification on the tortious interference claim, and that whole defense is going to turn on the Ford right of first refusal. It seems to me the focus of litigation is going to be the scope of that agreement. And the fact that there was an agreement with WIMCO just is just sort of, as Justice Medina says, ancillary to that determination.
Well, the purchase and sale agreement does reference Ford's right of first refusal, and I think the dissent in the Court of Appeals noted that really the claims are intertwined not only with the purchase and sale agreement but with Ford's right of first refusal. But I think the more appropriate way to look at it is Ford's right of first refusal doesn't even come into play until that purchase and sale agreement is not consummated, and the complaint, Ford would never have a reason, I'm sorry, until that agreement is entered, Ford Motor Company would have no reason to even exercise a right of first refusal. So what came first was the agreement to sell the dealership. And if you take the fact that the dealership was not transferred out of this fact pattern, the entire petition falls, there's no claim that can be asserted. And I think that's what the Grigson case from the Fifth Circuit was saying when it said that when each of the signatories claims against the non-signatory makes reference to or presumes the existence of a written contract, the claims arise out of and relate directly to the written agreement, and arbitration is appropriate.
Ford is kind of related to this transaction. It was in it from the beginning. But Meyer is kind of comes in at the end. Would it make any difference, or what's your view of this situation? Suppose that two parties have an agreement of any kind, and they've agreed to arbitrate their disputes, and some complete interloper, neither one of them contemplates at the time of their structuring of their relationship, comes in and tries to interfere with the contractual relations, tortiously interfere. Do you think if one party sues that interloper, arbitration would be required?
I believe so.
Seems to flow from your position.
That's exactly what happened in the Grigson case. It was a movie with Matthew McConaughey, and the owners of the movie sued Matthew McConaughey and his agency for tortious interference with the distribution agreement. And, Fifth Circuit held that was a classic situation where the equitable estoppel doctrine would apply. The agreement that the signatory plaintiff was complaining about was being asserted against the non-signatory, Matthew McConaughey and his agency. And based upon that, the reliance upon the agreement, with those duties is what required our equitable estoppel doctrine to be applied. The Court of Appeals also erred in finding that the arbitration clause was narrow and that therefore that precluded equitable estoppel. As far as I know, having researched this, I'm not aware of any other case that would suggest that a narrow arbitration clause would prevent the application of equitable estoppel. Now, I do concede there might be situations where you have a narrow arbitration clause, But the issue of whether a party is bound to that arbitration clause is a question of law that would be separate from the scope. And then once you decided that they are bound, then perhaps you would look at the scope to determine whether or not the party, the scope comes to it. The Court of Appeals here erred because they didn't apply the normal presumptions that that all doubts resolved in favor of arbitration. All those cases, such as this Court's In Re Merit case, was not cited in their opinion. The case law is very clear that parties opposing arbitration has the burden to show that the claims fall outside the arbitration clause. That's this Court's case in Prudential Securities versus
Marshall. But all of those are on the premise that you first established an agreement to arbitrate, and that's the question we're trying to decide here. I mean, yeah, well, there's a policy in favor of arbitration if the parties have agreed to it and they've signed it and bought into it. That's interesting, but not in this context, it's really not relevant.
In the first Merit case, that did deal with non-parties, arbitration among non-parties. Now, it was a different situation. It was a non-signatory plaintiff compelling a signatory defendant. We have a signatory plaintiff and a non-signatory defendant. So the situation is a little bit different, but it's still, the essence is still there that a party is bound to the contract, as this Court said, when you're suing upon the contract, you're bound by the terms of the contract, including the arbitration clause.
And no other term. I mean, it's only the arbitration clause that it seems you're relying on here. It's not as if you're trying to construe the terms of the contract or relying on obligations that are implicit in the contract.
That's correct. And I'm not sure there would be any other terms in the contract that we would complain about that would be unfair to avoid when they were sued based upon the obligations of that contract.
Thank you, counsel. The Court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May I please the Court? Mr. Darren Walker will present argument from the respondent.
May it please the Court. As I see it, there are two issues in the case. The first issue is the question of law of whether the claims asserted by WMCO are even within the scope of the arbitration agreement. And the second question is, even if they are, can or did the district court abuse its discretion by refusing to apply equitable estoppel under these circumstances? And I'll address the second question because I think that's the one that's of the most interest to the court. We have not disputed in this case the underlying assumption that equitable estoppel is available. So
the trial judge can just pick? That's where you're headed on abuse of discretion?
No.
I mean, we can't have trial judges in one part of the state enforce an arbitration clause and not in another. Non-signatories bound in one part of in one courtroom and not bound in the courtroom next door.
No, that's not what I'm suggesting.
Right. What's the discretion?
But in any case where the question is one of discretion for the trial judge.
Whether you're suing on the contract is an eight corners deal. We look at the contract and we look at the pleading, right?
For the first determination.
An eight corners rule for 100 years, that's never been a discretionary matter. We review that, then, we can read those things.
That's true.
What's the discretion?
The non-discretionary determination, the matter of law determination, is whether these claims are covered within the scope of the arbitration agreement. The discretionary determination is when a non-signatory who cannot rely on the contract seeks to enforce the contract, the arbitration clause in the contract, whether the other party is equitably estopped from relying on the non-signatory status as a non-signatory to defend against that claim.
So is it your position that if the trial court had ruled the other way, that would be okay too?
It might have been. It might have been. Because under the circumstances, the court would have to look at all the whatever evidence was provided. Now, I will suggest that in our case, if Judge Wilson had ruled differently, we would have argued that the WMCO never agreed to arbitrate these claims, because the only claims WMCO agreed to arbitrate were claims relating to disputes between WMCO and Bullock arising out of the construction or application of the terms of that contract. And there is no such dispute in this case.
Well, but wait a second. I mean, your client mean, the elephant in this case is that Ford had a right of first refusal, which they exercised.
That's true.
If they did so rightly, you lose.
Well, yes, our claim is based on the fact that their violation of the confidentiality agreement.
Right. So you being a good citizen, are asserting Bullock's defense that Ford breached the contract first by violating a confidentiality clause.
We are asserting our...
I mean, you've got to find some way around the first... There's a right of first refusal. That means normally, not anything about the facts of this case, that means normally you lose. You're an outsider. You want to buy a car dealership. Unless there's something illegal about the right of first refusal, you lose if Ford exercises its right of first refusal. So you've got to get around that. And so you say, oh, well, Ford's in breach of Bullock's contract.
Oh.
You're... I mean, that's... Am I right?
No, Judge. And with all due respect, we're saying Ford breached... Well, Ford is in breach of its contract with Bullock,
right.
Not in breach of Bullock's contract.
So you're asserting... You're, in effect, intervening yourself into somebody else's contract with an arbitration clause. Why aren't you bound by the arbitration clause?
Well, in this case, the... petitioner waived its reliance on the arbitration clause in the Ford Bullock contract.
Because you didn't sue them.
I'm sorry?
You didn't sue them, right?
We sued. Didn't sue who?
Bullock.
Bullock is a named defendant as a necessary party. The petition says that it is named as a necessary
you
party.
You didn't really sue them. You're not asking for any dime from them.
We don't claim Bullock did anything wrong. Other than the fact that it's prevented from consummating its contract with us. That's right. Well, there's no real dispute between Bullock and WMCO. Bullock wanted to sell WMCO the dealership. WMCO wanted to buy it. Ford exercised its right of first refusal that was in its separate contract with Bullock. Petitioners have not alleged that the trial court should have compelled arbitration based on the arbitration clause that was in Ford's contract with Bullock.
Yeah, but if you're right that Ford breached the confidentiality agreement, Bullock really wasn't forced. Bullock could have raised that argument, too.
Well, I suppose Bullock could have, yes.
So?
But I don't...
And we if it had and had requested arbitration, where would you be?
Well, I suppose that we would still have a separate claim against Ford, Meyer, and so forth, the same claims we've asserted here, and it would be a race to the courthouse for race adjudicata if the arbitration between Bullock and Ford were completed first,
But you think you would still not be required to arbitrate if Bullock were in the case, wanted relief, and sought arbitration?
If Bullock were in the case where it sued Ford, Judge, I will candidly admit that I haven't paid much attention to the arbitration agreement in the Ford-Bullock contract because the petitioner...
Assuming it says arbitrate everything.
If it's a broad arbitration clause that said all disputes relating to this agreement, the court would still have to apply equitable estoppel to bind WMCO to that contract because WMCO is not a signatory.
And what do you think the outcome would be?
And if WMCO were suing Ford under these claims, in that case, I still don't think that the elements of equitable estoppel, assuming this court were to adopt the same elements of equitable estoppel that the federal courts have, and I know that's an open question, but applying those elements, I don't think they apply because those two elements are, one, WMCO has to rely on the terms of the contract with the arbitration clause, and we are not relying on the terms of the WMCO Bullock contract.
But I think it's important to, you know, unravel the ends of this argument. So you're saying the arbitration could proceed, Bullock and Ford arbitration, and you would race to the courthouse and perhaps get, if you got, tortious interference finding first, and it wouldn't matter what happened in the arbitration? I mean, why shouldn't the law be that you, if you are asserting a tortious interference claim, the arbitration is already happening, that you ought to be compelled to arbitrate with everybody and put it in one tight package?
Well, that may I think that the short answer to that is that arbitration is a matter of agreement, consent, not coercion. And unless WMCO, who did not agree to arbitrate anything with Ford, were in some way equitably stopped from asserting that defense, that I'm not a party to this Ford bullet contract, then WMCO is being deprived of its right to proceed in court when it has never agreed to arbitrate.
Sure, you agreed to arbitrate. There's an arbitration clause in your contract your client signed.
Well, I was proceeding under the assumption that this was a hypothetical case.
Right, what you're trying to, the alleged inequity is you have artificially not sued Bullock. In fact, you have sued Bullock because they're the only one you had a contract with. But you just aren't asking for any damages because they were forced by Ford, even though you say Ford was breach. And I'm still unclear as why a defendant in a breach of contract is forced to do something if they have a defense to the contract.
Well, you asked two questions. The second one you asked was why a defendant is forced to do something when they have a right to do it under their contract.
When they have a right to avoid the contract.
Right. And that goes to the merits of our claim, but as I understand it, the
But that's the key. If the merits of your claim are governed by an arbitration clause, we don't want to do that in court.
But the merits, that's talking about Ford's obligations under the Ford-Bullock contract.
So why didn't you sue Bullock? This was the party who promised to deliver a dealership and didn't.
Well, because Bullock wanted to comply with the contract and Ford exercised its right of first refusal.
So assume the case was Ford did nothing and Bullock just refused to deliver the dealership. You would have sued Bullock for breach of contract and you would have had to arbitrate.
That's right.
So the reason you don't have to arbitrate is not what Bullock did, but why it did it.
No, the reason we don't have to arbitrate is because the party that's moved to compel arbitration is Ford, and Ford is not...
Again, only because you didn't sue Bullock. If you had sued Bullock, you would have had to arbitrate. If Bullock had done exactly what they did do, which is not give you the dealership, you would have sued, you would have had to arbitrate. But your argument is because the devil made them do it, then you don't have to arbitrate.
Well, Judge, it is true that because we are seeking relief from Ford for Ford's tortious conduct that does not arise out of the contract, our obligations in the contract between us and Bullock, that we claim we're not subject to arbitration. But I want to point out that your question gets to what I think is an important issue in this case, an important issue in equitable estoppel, and that is this is not like those cases where there is a subterfuge or an artificial attempt to enforce the terms of a contract against a signatory, against a non-signatory to evade an arbitration provision. This is a case where legitimately the reality of the situation is the bad actor is the third party. And so the cases that apply equitable estoppel do so because there's inequitable conduct that deprives one of the signatories of the benefit of his bargain, arbitration. And in Grigson, what they said was, look, even if the signatory is not sued in the case, he's dragged into litigation. He has to come in and testify and explain. And if you don't send the case to arbitration against the non-signatory, the signatory is deprived of the benefit of his bargain.
Well, not all of the cases require that there be some bad or inequitable conduct at issue here. Some of them just base it on other types of contract-based theories, implied contract, agency, and others. In fact, even the dissent in Grigson acknowledged that equitable estoppel is a good theory in an appropriate set of circumstances. Are you aware of any cases that have held, any jurisdictions where courts have held that as a matter of law, equitable estoppel will not apply in the arbitration context for non-signatories?
I'm not.
In fact, all of the ones that have even declined to apply it in a particular case acknowledge that in appropriate cases it would govern the circumstances.
That's exactly what the court in this case did.
Now, you've said several times that you're not suing on the contract between, you're not suing Ford for obligations arising from the contract between WMCO and Bullock. However, you are, aren't you? Your petition says that Ford and its assignee violated the terms of the Ford agreement in failing to treat the agreement between Bullock and plaintiff confidentially. Because of the breach of that confidentiality agreement, that caused the interference. Isn't that your claim?
Yes, but the
you're suing on a breach of confidentiality that which is an obligation that was in the WMCO Bullock contract.
No, that obligation was in the Ford Bullock contract. Ford's right of first refusal had a condition in it that they had to keep the terms of the Bullock contract with the third party confidential. So that's, and I'm glad you asked that question, because if I didn't make that clear, I wanted to.
What's your damages your client suing for?
Well, they're unspecified, but I would assume that it's loss of profits from the operation of the dealership. I don't dispute that.
So if it's the benefit of the bargain, how are you not suing based? I mean, how's a jury going to calculate what WMCO would have made without using the terms of the WMCO Bullock contract?
Well, the only, in the sense that the thrust or the purpose of the WMCO Bullock contract was the sale of the dealership, that will come into evidence, and that will be a basis for the jury to assess the damages in this case. Our argument is that standing alone, the fact that the contract is going to be in evidence, that it is an evidentiary fact, that is a basis of the claim, and that it might even be considered by the jury in assessing damages, is not enough to apply equitable estoppel.
So, I mean, the benefit of the bargain is I'm buying a dealership worth this, and I'm buying with a profit stream of this, and I'm buying it at this price. And this price only comes in the WMCO Bullock contract.
That's true.
So we cannot calculate your client's damages without reference to the WMCO contract.
Well, that's true, but that is not attempting to impose a duty upon Ford arising out of the WMCO contract.
It's collecting from Ford exactly the damages you would have collected from Bullock for a breach if Ford had not been around.
Well, and other damages. I mean, we're suing Ford under tort theory, so assuming there would probably be other elements of damage, but one element of damage probably would be the same as if Bullock had breached. Our argument is essentially that the petitioner's view of equitable estoppel is so broad that it would swallow the rule that parties should not be compelled to arbitrate disputes they didn't agree to arbitrate unless there is some good reason in equity to make them do that. And the courts that have addressed the issue have established these sort of two alternative tests for good reasons in equity. We don't think, and the Hill case out of the Fifth Circuit that came after Grigson, you know, it held that just because the contract is an important fact or the claim is dependent on the contract is not enough, the party must actually be trying to enforce the terms of the contract against the non-signatory, but at the same time try to avoid the unpleasant arbitration clause. So I cannot dispute, and you raise valid points, that the fact that there is this contract between WMCO and Bullock to sell the dealership, that's an important fact in the case. I would just argue that if that is enough to force someone to arbitrate a dispute that they had not agreed to arbitrate, then the exception of equitable estoppel swallows the fundamental rule that arbitration is a matter of consent, not coercion. And even if it would be convenient or judicially effective to force a party who never agreed to do so to arbitrate, the countervailing policy of only holding parties to contracts they agreed to supersedes that. and that's our position.
Well, but Bullock breached the contract. Whether the reason for it, their motive, is really irrelevant to the fact that they breached.
That's true.
And you're trying to ignore the fact that they breached to keep from arbitrating with Bullock.
Well, we have elected, we named Bullock as a necessary party. We have elected to pursue a viable, valid tort claim against Ford. And there may be all kinds of reasons for a plaintiff to elect not to sue someone.
But you don't have a tortious interference claim if there was no breach by Bullock.
Well, I suppose we wouldn't have any damages. If Bullock had gone ahead and sold us the dealership.
No, if Bullock has a good excuse for not performing, it's not a breach. If Bullock didn't.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, I suppose that's right. If there was a valid exercise of the right of first refusal by Ford, then Bullock was not obligated to transfer the dealership. So,
you lose then.
I think that's right. If the violation of the confidentiality provision did not void the right of first refusal, that's the major tenet as I read the complaint.
Let me ask you a different question on first merit. Non-signatory, if you bring the same claims on the contract, you're bound by the arbitration clause. What if a non-signatory has two causes of action, one on the contract and one tort completely unrelated, separate, and apart from, maybe even a different part of the transaction? What do we do? Do we send both of those to the arbitrator?
I don't think so. I think that the courts can sever non-arbitrable claims.
Normally, let me ask you a few more facts. Normally, if there's an arbitration agreement, we leave it up to the arbitrator to decide whether issues are inside or outside of the arbitration clause. Wouldn't the best rule, if you have both, to send them to the arbitrator and decide after arbitration whether one of them's off or on? Because otherwise we're going to have two lawsuits.
I'm aware of the rules that say that, you know, all these different things are matters for the arbitrator to decide if there's a valid arbitration clause. On the other hand, I am, and I can't cite you any cases that support this. I'm giving you my thought. But I'm of the opinion that if a party has specifically, for example, in this case, it's a fairly narrow arbitration clause. We agree to arbitrate disputes between us about the terms of this contract. And I'm sorry, I didn't see my...
Finish.
May I finish?
Yeah.
I don't think it's fair to send a claim to an arbitrator to decide when it's clearly not covered under the scope of the arbitration clause.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
What do you think about that? One clearly on the contract, one clearly not. What do we do with them?
I think you would send it to arbitration. There is going to be a point at which, if the arbitration award comes out, the court is going to have to decide whether or not those claims did fall under the arbitration clause or not. So it's probably more efficient for a court to send it to all to arbitration, let the arbitrator decide, and then if the arbitrator decided wrongly, it could be corrected. But at some point, a court is going to have to decide whether those claims fell in there. I would like to react to one of the comments made by the respondents that the equitable estoppel doctrine, as we're propounding from the Grixon case in the Fifth Circuit, is so broad that it would swallow the rule that a party who did not agree to arbitrate cannot be compelled to arbitrate. I don't believe that is the case, that it's going to be so broad. I mean, the language from the Grixon case and the MS Dealer case from the 11th Circuit, which it relied upon, I mean, it's sort of a collection of what's been going on in the federal circuits for about 20 years now. And it's fairly narrow. It says that the agreement, the claim against the non-signatory must reference or presume the existence of a written agreement. Now, he's correct. The Hill case decided by the Fifth Circuit did say you can't just have a claim which touches upon an agreement with an arbitration clause and the whole thing goes to arbitration. That's a correct decision. There's another case cited by both parties in the briefs but not really discussed very much, the Muhammad case. Which I think is a good example of a situation where it's not going to be so broad. The Muhammad case was an employer-employment situation. The employee signed an employment contract which contained an arbitration clause. The employee sued the employer for race discrimination. Well, the employment contract contained an arbitration clause, but the race discrimination claim was not compelled to arbitration in that situation. So another example, I think, in using our facts is, let's assume Ford had defamed WMCO during this transaction and said, you know, terrible things to the public about WMCO. That might be a claim that would not fall into the arbitration, or should not be compelled to arbitration, because it doesn't really rely upon the agreement. Now, the agreement would be involved somehow, because that's why Ford got involved.
Well, but, I mean, as I understand the federal cases, nobody's ever said the only times equitable estoppel come in is intertwined claims or suit on the contract. They've said that's two situations it does. And as I understand equitable estoppel in the federal courts, it's a doctrine that means exactly what it says. We're going to estop you because it's equitable, which could be very broad.
Well, and I don't
anytime we want to stop somebody from complaining about arbitration because we don't think it's fair, we can do it.
And I think what the Grigson court was trying to do was trying to put limits on any sort
of... They certainly didn't say these are the only two where we're ever going to apply equitable estoppel.
They did say it was...
In effect, four or five of the different alter ego agency, et cetera, could also be called equitable estoppel. We're stopping somebody from avoiding arbitration because it ain't fair under the circumstances.
They could be, but... Those other theories, alter ego, those come from...
But if the federal courts keep going broader, we should follow along, if Mr. Walker's correct, that it is broad.
I think Texas would want, in applying the Texas Arbitration Act, to follow the Federal Arbitration Act to some extent. But, I mean, certainly the courts in the state are able to prevent the slippery slope that you're talking about from any claims. And I think they've already done it. I think the Muhammad case is a perfect example. You don't compel a race discrimination claim based upon arbitration clause in an employment contract or in a policy manual. I think all of the claims in this case clearly rely upon the agreement, the buy-sell agreement. And I think one of the things I pointed out in the brief is that if there was any question as to whether or not it was going to relate upon these claims, one thing that a party could do in this situation is stand up and say, I stipulate my claims will not rely upon the purchase and sale agreement. If you think you could separate the claims based upon the...
I think that's what Mr. Walker says. You doubt it. You disagree, especially on the fourth allegation, right?
And I haven't heard any such stipulation. I mean, I think he says it could be done, but it hasn't been done. And that would be one way to clearly allow a court to go forward and say, well, we'll only litigate those claims that don't rely upon it. And as the evidence comes in, if it looks like it relies upon the agreement, those will have to be sent to arbitration.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will have to brief recess.
All right.
pretty quickly.
Yeah, it goes by really quickly.